The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome her.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be back here. Philadelphia feels like a second home to me. I spent a lot of years here some time ago, and it's very nice to be back. The air we breathe, as my kind introducer said, takes place in 1916 and 1917 in a large public sanatorium in the northern Adirondack Mountains. Most of the patients there have been sent there from larger cities, primarily New York. Most of them are immigrants, and all of them are poor. Patients who can afford to pay for their own care stay in private boarding houses called cure cottages, and there's a lot of these a few miles away in the neighboring village. It's really the intersection of those two groups of people that drives the plot of this novel. What I was trying to do with this group of characters trapped in their little petri dish in their isolated mountain settings, it's funny, I always think in scientific metaphors too, but I do think of them as trapped in this little dish. I was trying to illuminate some of the parallels between that time, just as America was about to enter a terrible war, and our own time, and also some of the parallels between the growing sense of suspicion and paranoia, the sudden xenophobia, and the equally sudden constriction of civil rights. Some of you might know some earlier books of mine, Ship Fever, Servants of the Map, or The Voyage of the Narwhal. For those of you who do, you'll recognize a few characters and places in this new novel. In particular, a character named Leo Marburg, who appears here as a young man, later becomes the grandfather of Rose and Bianca Marburg, from stories called The Marburg Sisters, The Mysteries of Ubiquitin, and the forest. Tamarack State, the sanatorium where Leo is confined, is also the village in which Elizabeth Vine runs her cure cottage in a story called The Cure. And the village of Tamarack Lake itself is the place where Ned Kind, after his stint as ship's cook on the ship called the Narwhal, ends up retiring. I'm just going to read a few pages from the opening of the novel. Imagine a hill shaped like a dog's head, its nose pointed south and resting on crossed front paws. The main buildings of Tamarack State Sanatorium for the treatment of tuberculosis, including the two long brick wings where we used to cure, are set where the eyes would be. There's a siding at the base of the hill, four posts, a metal roof, space for a cart, and the portable steps, where the train makes a special stop, and where, on arrival day, we'd each looked up to see the sanatorium windows staring back at us. We all remember looking down for the first time after getting settled in one of those wings to see the new arrivals sagging down the steps or being passed on stretchers through the windows of the train. Back then, we lay on our porches in orderly rows, the two chairs assigned to each room, still separated by shoulder-high panels and sheltered by canvas awnings. Fields surrounded us, they still do, and also a river, three ponds, and the road curving down toward the village. After the cities from which we'd come, this looked to us like wilderness. Rivers, mountains, wild geese honking. The air meant to cure us pouring antiseptically through the woods. The Adirondacks were new to us, and we were shocked to learn that Canada was so near. The snow shocked us too, along with the dark winter days and the heavy mist that sometimes blanketed the fields. A fox, hunting, would brush his tail through the surface, leaving a track we followed with our eyes. Ducks escaping the fox would burst into the air as if they'd been shot. The sight made us think that our own lives, hidden similarly, might still be launched on their proper paths. We weren't a big group even then. 60 women and 60 men, if every spot was taken, and a single arrival shifted scores of relationships, as did a single discharge or a death. On the porches, we gossiped as eagerly as we drew breath. Twice each week, if the mist didn't block our view, the train pulled up to our unmarked siding, and we inspected who might join us next. In late July of 1916, the train from New York City brought us Leo Marburg. Tall, thin, with black hair worn too long and big hands with spatulate fingertips, he paused on the boarding steps until a porter passed him like a sack of wheat to the driver of our cart. The driver, without asking, draped Leo over the pallet in the back. Leo forced himself back up. "I'm not that sick," he said. Up on the hill, our windows blinked at him. "Let me sit beside you." He eased himself down and around until, with the driver's grudging help, he was on the bench and looking out over the horses. The cart climbed from the siding and up the track, the buildings dotting the lower slope wavering slightly in the suffocating haze. Staff cottages, laundry, incinerator, power plant. He recognized only the stables, the others he'd learn later. The mountains were cool, he'd been told in the city, the air crisp and restorative. So what was this steamy batting wrapped around him? Inside the door of our central building, Leo found it hotter still. The linoleum floor felt sticky. The hands of the nurse to whom the driver delivered him were hot and moist, and she treated him, Leo thought, like a bag of raw sugar being taken off a ship. Plop into the wheelchair, plop on his carpet bag into his lap, plop on top of the carpet bag when a pamphlet bound in olive paper. "Rule book," this said helpfully. "Read it," said the nurse. Before he had time to glimpse more than a few of what seemed like hundreds of rules, she pointed out his patient number, inscribed in white ink on the booklet's cover, and then a page where he was meant to sign his name. Above it was a statement saying he'd read the rules and agreed to abide by them. "I understand that I am occupying a bed badly needed for someone else, that I am fortunate to be here, and that only by obeying the rules conscientiously can I show my value to the community." "Signed," she said. We'd all been through this, and all, like Leo, had felt uniquely prosecuted. She pushed a pen at him, prodded his hand, said good when his hand obeyed her request, and then rolled him briskly down the corridor and into the lift that rose to the infirmary. What had he signed? As if to make up for his slowness, she recited rules as they whisked along. No talking during his initial period of total bed rest. No smoking, no laughing, no singing, no reading, no writing. Do not get out of bed for any reason. Bathroom privileges come later. Do not think gloomy thoughts. Eat what's put in front of you. Rest. Think only of resting. How was this better than Brooklyn? When the lift opened, he saw metal beds in which lay long lumps, not talking, not moving, not singing. Then he was inside a bathroom with a dark red floor. Toilets to one side, wash basins on the other. An adjoining room held a huge white tub in which the nurse proceeded to boil him. That he'd had a bath before getting on the train meant nothing to her. All new patients must be bathed on admission, she said firmly. This was a rule. So, too, was the astonishing temperature of the water, the disinfectant she poured in a copious stream, the harsh green soap with which she washed his hair. He tried not to wince as she scrubbed at his arms and back. not to choke, as she rested the heel of her hand on his head and gently, but quite firmly, pushed his head under the water. "Take a breath," she said, and then he was under, panic rising in him so swiftly that he could see before it happened, his body bursting from the water, leaping upright, shaking off droplets like a dog. He stood there, naked and breathing heavily. "That's not going to do us much good," she said calmly. "I still have to rinse you off, but I can use a pitcher if you'd prefer." He squatted back down, squeezing shut his eyes while she poured water over his head. "Count," he thought, as the acrid water streamed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. He had always hated being underwater, but how could she have known that? When she was done, she draped him in towels and inspected his bag, first pulling on white cotton gloves. Piece by piece, she pincered out and laid on a metal table 2 pairs of flannel pajamas, a shabby woolen robe, a sweater, pants, a few shirts, underwear, books. "Why didn't you bring warmer clothes?" "I packed exactly what the tuberculosis nurse in Brooklyn told me to," Leo said. She shook her head and made a note on the clipboard. "We keep telling them these are completely insufficient. Put on those pajamas for now." While he dressed, she bundled up his belongings. "No books. You won't be reading for quite a while. We'll issue you appropriate clothes from the storeroom. The other things we'll fumigate and put away. I need the address of your next of kin, so we know who to contact if that becomes necessary." She stood with her pencil poised. "I have no family in this country," he finally said. "Why else would I be here?" "If you don't appreciate how lucky you are to be given this chance to cure," she said, "and to be supported by the state while your health improves, there are plenty who'd be glad to change places with you." "How many times have we heard that?" "You have no family?" "None," he said. She shook her head. "Another one. Where do you all come from?" If he'd had a place to go, he might have walked away. "I'm grateful to be here," he said instead. He was 26 years old, and the nurse had just touched everything he owned. On a machinist's hand, he could count the friends, Vincenzo from the sugar refinery, Meyer from the boat, who knew or cared where he was. She stowed him in an empty ward, the top sheets of the bed around him pulled so taut that the edges hovered above the blankets. "All of us," he later learned, "started out here, wedged between those cotton sheets and one of the white enameled beds, each separated from its neighbor by a small white cupboard." He learned to eat, propped up very slightly, from a white tray on a wheeled stand that swung over his chest. He learned to use a bedpan, to brush his teeth and wash his face in bed, to cough always into a paper handkerchief, and expectorate into a waxed paper sputum cup, casting cups and handkerchiefs into a paper bag pinned to his stand. He learned that his meals, which came on trays, would almost always be cold, but would be garnished by a bit of folded, colored paper, a daily thought. Resting is done with the mind as well as the body. Getting well depends on you. On Thursday, his weekly bath day, he squinted with fear when an orderly came, heaved him from his bed onto a stretcher, and rolled the stretcher into the bathroom, but the tub was now off limits to him. Instead, he was sponged gingerly and then patted dry, covered with blankets, and inserted back into bed. Food came endlessly, more than he'd seen since childhood. The nurse followed the food cart, taking his temperature and his pulse. And the minute she left, "Coughing can be controlled," she scolded. He hacked and heaved and rattled in ways that he couldn't before have imagined. In the early evening, a resident doctor made rounds, peering briefly at him and then making notes on his chart. If all went well, the doctor said, and he rested thoroughly and ate everything, he might be allowed in a few weeks to walk once a day to the bathroom, to sit in a chair for 15 minutes, to read or write for another 15. I'm going to stop there and let you wonder what happens to Leo next. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Claire Massoud, and I want to thank you all for coming and thank the library for having me and to say what a thrill it is to read with Andrea, who is such a wonderful writer and such a wonderful friend. I'm going to read. May I play with this? Down a little? That seems. I'm going to read from The Emperor's Children, which is set in New York City in 2001. It takes me about 15 minutes to describe it, but my editor describes it as a novel about three friends. It's much shorter. I feel not entirely true, but good enough. There are certainly these three friends who are on the cusp of 30. They're friends from university who at the age of 30 have not perhaps accomplished all the things they might have. One of them is named Marina Thwaite, and she is the daughter of a prominent liberal journalist named Murray Thwaite. Her friends are Danielle and Julius. And she has been writing a book about the semiotics of children's clothes for about 7 years. She got a big advance. She spent it. She broke up with her boyfriend and came home, and she's living with her parents. And the chapter I'm going to read is a chapter involving Murray and Marina. And Annabelle is Mrs. Thwaite. Aurora is their housekeeper. And I think that's all you need to know. The chapter is called Talking to a Grown Child. This is still daunting. Anyway, because his desk faced the window, Murray Thwaite did not at first realize that his daughter had opened the door to his study, directly behind his back, had entered and had sat cross-legged upon the divan against the wall. To have accomplished this silently was no mean feat, because the divan, untouched by Aurora in accordance with his instructions, was piled end to end with manuscripts and file folders, with stacks of hardcover volumes riffled by post-it notes, with yellowing newspapers clipped and unclipped. In order for Marina to have sat, and to have sat in her yogic position, she had to have moved at least two piles onto the floor. Although he wouldn't show it, not over such a trifle, he was irritated by the intrusion. It was a household rule that nobody entered Murray's office without first knocking, and that unless the door was already ajar, which he was fairly certain it had not been, one did not knock at all, except in dire emergency. Nobody touched his papers. Nobody moved his piles. Nobody entered the inner sanctum unbidden. As he had explained more than once, in this room his brain was laid out in all its idiosyncrasy. To be in this room was to be in his head, and he relied upon his household to behave accordingly, which, almost unfailingly, they did. On this evening, past midnight, Murray Thwaite had been so certain of his privacy that he had taken the file from his locked desk drawer, the book file he thought of as his life's work, the project that, when it was completed, if it was ever completed, but what then would he do if it were completed, if it was indeed his life's work, would at last and indisputably elevate his name from the ranks of competent, even courageous journalists and thoughtful columnists to the rare air of the immortals. It was a work. He hesitated even to form the word in his mind, and yet his sense of self, of what this was all for, depended upon that formulation of philosophy. Partly aphoristic, partly essayistic, it was to be the distillation crystalline of all he had learned and knew and had come to live by. In his mind, although not on paper, the book had a title: How to Live. Simple, pithy, and yet he feared grandiose, too grandiose for what was yet only an uneven pile of handwritten pages, blotched with coffee rings, dog-eared, marked up, read 1,000 unsatisfied times by one and only one pair of eyes. Annabelle knew of this manuscript the way a child knows about Narnia, with a mixture of hope and incredulity. And since returning home, Marina seemed to have surmised that some vital, unscheduled enterprise was secretly afoot, something she referred to with an ironic obliquity as Dad's thing. Aside from these two, nobody at all knew, as far as Murray was aware, of this text. How could he know, and why would he imagine that Marina had in fact told Danielle and Julius, and possibly others, that her father's next big project was a top-secret manuscript that not even she had yet seen, so that among her acquaintances there circulated rumors about Murray Thwaite's thing, rumors that suggested an expose of the CIA, or the Communist Party, or from one particularly silly corner cookery, brunch recipes from Murray Thwaite's kitchen, but did not, of course could not, come close to the truth. The manuscript made him nervous. He didn't know how to proceed with it. He'd never written anything like it before. The number of its pages grew or shrank, depending only on his humor, as he could read the same passage 20 times, finding it splendid, illuminating the first 19, and daft or banal the 20th. And even then, he would determine purely on a whim whether to discard the offending sheet, or whether indulgently to put the page aside in hopes that a 21st reading, in a sunnier frame, would restore its luster to the offending prose. Because the manuscript made him nervous, he frequently avoided it, often for months at a time, a tic that, given his prolificity and the constant public demands upon him, was not difficult to justify. Only when he felt himself to be genuinely settled, not merely unmolested, but in some profound sense unmolestable, did he take out this infinitely precious file, as he had felt this evening, until his daughter. He loved her, adored her, of course he did, but he did ask himself, as he noted her faded pajamas, her curled bare toes, why this woman, no longer in her first youth, was living still or again in his house, had intruded. "Daddy," she said, picking without looking at a small scab on her ankle, "are you busy?" "Am I busy, pet?" He peered above his glasses with what he hoped was a loving sternness. "What does it look like?" "I know the door was shut, but I thought I really need to talk to you." "We could have talked at supper, my beauty." It's not that it's private, although it sort of is. It's mostly that you'll understand, and, Mom, I wanted to talk to you on your own." Murray removed his glasses, allowed them to dangle professorially while he chewed upon a stem. He did not say anything. "But if you've got a deadline?" Her anxiety rang false. He knew that she didn't care whether he had a deadline. She cared only about the conversation she wanted to have with him. In this sense, in her single-mindedness, he might even have said her bloody-mindedness, she was her father's daughter. Only sometimes, such as now, did the trait annoy him. But he knew that she would have been, on approaching his inner sanctum, as apprehensive as she was determined. He could feel from afar the clamminess of her palms, the palpitations of her heart, and with a sigh, the sigh of parental responsibility, he resigned himself. He shuffled his papers, slid them into their folder, turned it face down, all with a nonchalance that suggested they were of no possible importance, and shifted himself in his chair so that he could look properly at his daughter and, as she required of him, converse. "So," he said, and held out his flat hands. Marina gave half a laugh. "You make me feel silly now, Daddy. It's suddenly all formal, like there's a script, and I don't know." He cut her off. "Do you want to ask me something, or do you want to tell me something?" Marina thought a moment. "Neither. Both. What kind of question is that?" "Marina, dear, you've got to think clearly. You've got to learn to articulate your thoughts clearly. Clarity is the key. You make it sound so simple. But it is. That, at least, is simple. You make everything sound simple, and it's not. You're always so certain of everything." He sighed. "Don't whine, Marina. It doesn't become you, and don't speak nonsense. There are those things about which I have sufficient information to be certain. And then there's a great deal, of course, that is a muddle." Marina nodded, played with her toes, would not look at him. He was in so many ways extremely proud of her, not least of her beauty, which was to him each time a surprise, as though unwittingly he had thrown a perfect pot or cultivated a perfect bonsai. But she could be, she was being, trying. They heard a siren approach on the avenue below, heard its rising shriek, and then the fall as it passed them continued away. As if she had been waiting politely for it to finish, Marina began, "I just wanted to ask for your advice about, you know, things." "Which ones? The book?" He was tiring of the pretense of her book, not least because it made him wonder whether his book was as farcical a sham as his daughter's. "No." She peered up at him through her hair, which she had coquettishly encouraged across half of her face. "Or not just that." She paused. "It's the whole setup. I mean, I'm 30 now, aren't I?" "You are. And when you were 30, you were already famous." "Famous." He shrugged modestly, a shrug as artificial as his daughter's earlier anxiety. He could see her seeing the falsehood. They knew each other well. And then he said, and meant, "It was a very different time. It was a different world." "Yes, but you were doing important things from the start. You had convictions." "World events. It was an opportunity. I believed in a lot of things, some of which hold true today, and a lot of which, well, as we were saying, very little is certain. But, Daddy, what am I going to do? Murraythwaite blinked. She was so lovely and so charming, but she'd been these things for a long time, all her life, and he thought he had instilled in her the importance of being more than they. He did not want to suspect she was not bright. He knew her. He knew she was bright. Not as bright, perhaps, as her friend Danielle, but intelligent enough for there to be no excuse, no possible excuse for this behavior. He manifested his displeasure by breathing dragon-like through his nose. He could feel his nostrils flaring. To give her time, he lit a cigarette, emptied the dirty ashtray into the waste paper basket at his feet. Aurora lined the baskets with plastic shopping bags to facilitate her cleaning, and the butts and ashes rustled against the plastic like leaves in a breeze. "Danielle thinks I should get a job," Marina said at last. "What kind of job did you have in mind?" "That's the thing. First off, should I even have one when I'm trying to finish the book? And then, you know, a real job would be so demanding. After all, that's what an interesting job is supposed to be, and an easy job, a dumb job. Well, at that point, who am I kidding?" Murraythwaite had little patience for this. He suddenly saw his daughter as a monster he and Annabelle had created, they and a society of excess. He was about to begin, "When I was your age," but suddenly could hear his own father's voice in his head intoning these words that he had sworn to himself. He remembered it, his irritation. He would never speak to his own children. He said instead, "You know you're welcome here as long as you like. A bed, a roof, your dinner you've got, and a little cash too, as long as your mother and I can manage it." Marina nodded, as if chastened by his generosity, waiting for what might follow. What, he wondered, should follow. "But the question is, what do you want to do with your life?" "I want, you know, what I've always wanted, Daddy, to do something important." Could she not hear herself? Even that student at Columbia, what was her name? Marianne Rowan, that was it. Even she had surely not been so naive and 10 years younger, too. "Meaning?" he pressed. "With writing. I'd like to write something. Articles, a book that mattered." "But on what subject? What do you believe in?" "Not children's clothes, that's for sure," she snorted ruefully. I don't know. There are so many things. You of all people know what it's like." "Different issues are important to different people, my girl, as you're well aware. It's not just a matter of picking something off a list, of following someone else's ideas. If I've taught you anything, surely I've taught you that. You've got to find your subject, or a first subject, something to start with." "But how?" "Maybe in the first instance your friend has a point. Maybe you should get a job of some kind." "In journalism? In anything that interests you? Teach school? Work for an aid agency? Work for an ad agency, for God's sake? Just a job?" I suppose what I worry is," Marina gave her father a self-deprecating smile, to his mind one of her most bewitching expressions, "I worry that that will make me ordinary, like everybody else." "My beauty." He stood to give her a hug, pointedly cutting short the interview, and she, too, unfurled from the divan, stepping as daintily as a dancer over the pile she had relocated to the floor. "Nothing under the sun could make you ordinary, nothing ever. Now I need to work, because, you see, I do have a job. It concentrates the mind." He let her get as far as the door before he spoke again. "Will you finish this book, then, after all the work you've done on it?" She had her hand upon the doorknob. He could tell from the way that she held it that she was feeling its cool brass and the shape of her palm, her fingers around its surface. He felt that he knew her, the line of her spine, the curve of her eyes, and that he did not really need her to answer his question. "I don't know yet," she said. "I'm still trying to figure it out." He nodded. She was in the hallway, the door not quite shut, when he called a final time her name. "Marina?" "Yes, Daddy." "Do you know your friend Danielle's email offhand? I said I'd forward some stuff to her about that Jones fellow. You know, the one she wants to make a flick about." "That's so sweet," Marina smiled, showing only her head around the door. "It'll mean a lot to her." Once Marina had gone, Murraythwaite sat again before his open folder. He took a clean sheet of paper and wrote at the top, "Chapter 10, Counseling an Adult Daughter." He crossed this out, wrote, "Conversations with an Adult Daughter," and then, "A Grown Child Ponders How to Live." At the last, he settled upon "Talking to a Grown Child," which words sat in the middle of the page in black ink, in his long, narrow capital letters. He smoked several cigarettes while looking at this phrase and emptied the tumbler of scotch that rested on his blotter, its sweat sunk into the green paper in a solemn little ring. Eventually, he put the sheet of paper on top of the manuscript pile and returned them all to the folder and to the drawer, which he locked carefully. She had, this was, of course, what one's children did, ruined his stride, spoiled his momentum. Thank you.
is scary.
It is.
And it's the usual. We'll have a Q&A. If you raise your hand, we'll get the mic to you. Anyone like to start us off? Gentleman about 10 rows back.
Doris Lessing won the Nobel Prize. And this afternoon, Harold Bloom checked in by calling it a travesty of political correctness. Would you care to comment on Ms. Lessing's worthiness or his comment?
We will now engage in jousting for who's going to take that hot potato first. I suspect we don't have quite the same feelings about this, so this is good. You'll get two answers. Oh, sorry. I much admire her early work and think it still has a lot to say. I don't know her later work, which is science fiction, so I can't judge on it, but I did think his comment was uncalled for and very snippy. So
I was unaware of his comment until just now, and I'm not. It seems not unsurprising.
No.
I have to say we both earlier expressed surprise at this particular awarding of the prize. I mean, I suppose they're often a surprise, but this one did seem a surprise. We were talking about the fact that when Thomas Mann was awarded the prize, it was specifically the Nobel Prize. It was specifically said to him that it was for Buddenbrooks, which he wrote at the age of 25, and not for all the many amazing novels he wrote later, including The Magic Mountain, which I guess the judges didn't like so much. Certainly, it is. The logic of the of awarding it to Lessing, I think, is in having written a single hugely influential book a very long time ago. Unlike Andrea, I have read some of her more recent work, and I have to say, on the strength of that work, it would indeed be a travesty. Her more recent science fiction isn't, I'm not a great science fiction reader, so perhaps I'm not able to judge the genre properly, but the work of hers, the more recent work of hers that I have read, is not memorable, and not influential. but her early work really was and is, and there is a logic to that. There is a logic. I mean, she broke ground for a great deal of literature that wouldn't have been written.
Yeah, I think
without
that's
her.
Right. We were speculating a little on the idea that in the sciences, it's actually very common for Nobel Prizes to go to older scientists for work that was done 30, 40 years ago, which has turned out often to found a new field. And that's not generally been the case with the prizes in literature, but maybe they were working with that model going back to the Golden Notebook, which is 61, 62, something like that, and how great... how a great many women writers were influenced by that book and how many books did grow out of that, and perhaps that was the thinking behind the award. We're just guessing. But.
Another question? Gentleman about 5 rows back.
First, I want to congratulate both of you for wonderful readings, which were both very enjoyable. I'd like to ask Andrea Barrett to elaborate, if she will, on what her connection is to Philadelphia.
I lived here for 3 years in the early 80s. I was here from 81 to 84. And it's also where I first, my first visits to the Academy of Natural Sciences, which turned out later to be hugely important in a lot of my work. Also some of the work at the Academy of Fine Arts, the Thomas Eakins painting. I've ended up setting a fair number of stories and parts of novels here. Something about this area, I think because of its deep connection to mid-19th century natural history, has been an unshakable foundation for me. I keep bringing characters back here or sending them forth from here. So it's a very resonant place for me still. I haven't lived here since... I think we moved in 84. It's been a long time, but it's very alive in my imagination.
Your heart.
Part of my heart is here.
Luckily, she still has some part of her heart with her.
Indeed.
About 5 to 8 rows back on the right here, or am I right?
Hello. I was hoping you could speak a little bit about your research methods when you're when you've got a germ of an idea for a novel or a story. You know, what sort of research do you do, and how do you conduct that research?
Great. Why don't you start with that one?
Yeah. It's so dependent on the individual case. I wrote my second novel is set in France and a bit in the United States, and involves a lot of history about the pieds noirs, the French in Algeria, and we lived in D.C. at the time, and that was a wonderful stroke of luck because I spent a lot of time in the Library of Congress, calling up. You can call up anything you want, and anything from oral histories of the war, the Algerian war, things that were published as pamphlets and not always as books, to a wonderful resource for me because my protagonist was of school age, and of course the French education system is highly centralized, so you're either studying something or you're not at a certain age at a certain time. And in the Library of Congress was a literally typed and Xeroxed pamphlet written by some organization of mothers who, when sent abroad to France as American expatriate wives, wanted to exchange educational information, and it listed what children did in the French schools at every... It was only about 10 years old, and it listed what French kids did in the schools at every year the whole way up. So there's a certain amount of discovery along the way of what exists. I think it's a balance between finding out information so you have enough to be going on with and not being distracted by research so that you don't get on with the... There comes a point where you have to drop the research and write the story and then figure out the little holes you need to fill in rather than creating the background. I mean, that's my experience, but...
That's pretty much mine too, and a lot of other writers I've talked to who do a lot of research have spoken about this kind of back and forth movement. I have to do some research to start the novel or the story. I have to know where my characters live and when and what's going on roughly, and I'll soak in material for quite a long time, aware all the time that I don't actually know enough to begin writing, not even close enough to begin writing, but then I'll start writing. And almost immediately, as soon as the first few paragraphs come out sometimes, a whole set of possibilities falls away. Things that I thought I was going to need to research, I don't need to. The ship is not going in that direction. Things that I didn't know I needed to research correspondingly pop up very quickly. And then after that, there's a constant interplay between writing and research. Always with the very important qualification in mind that Claire mentioned, which is at some point I really have to stop and just put it all away and write, or the book just becomes a collection of research. So,
right here.
When you walk into a small independent bookstore, what authors do you find irresistible that you have to own, preferably in hardcover, as soon as it becomes available?
Well, I always have to have what Alice Munro is doing. Whatever it is, I have to have it, and I have to have it right then. I have a lot of friends who are writers, like most writers, and many of them, if I see a new book out, I also have to have that right now, so that's a biggish circle. There's also the Irish writer William Trevor I'm very fond of. I look for him wherever I go. And then there are other books that are subject-driven rather than writer-driven. So if I see something about Arctic history that is new and just looks very appetizing, even if I don't know the writer, often my hand will stray in that direction. There's an unfortunately rather large set of subjects that do that to me. So I have too many books, like all writers do.
I like you, am a great Alice Munro fan. I'm a big P.
Peter Carey fan, the Australian writer Peter Carey. I've missed a few, but I try to read the Philip Roths. I do keep up. There are certain ones that I feel as though the trouble, I find books immensely alluring, and so it's very dangerous. There are so many things one wishes one would read. And when feeling extravagant, you think, well, I will read that. And it's not that, you know, you would, given World Enough and Time, but the danger for me is buying books about subjects I know nothing about. It seems to me the joy of the independent bookstore is that if you have faith in their choices, then probably you're going to want almost everything that's on the the table, and that's a problem. But that's also the great thrill. It's so different from walking into a huge bookstore, a chain bookstore, and it's a bit like looking for a needle in a haystack. I've never been to Turkey, and I'm taking a trip to Turkey later this year. And so I went in Cambridge. There's a little travel bookshop, and it's a wonderful bookshop, and of course, I wanted every book in the Turkey section, which was a problem. But I, you know, I'm not going to. Then I had to say to myself, as if I were my own parent, which ones, dear, will you actually read? You know, and I came away with Orhan Pamuk's book on Istanbul, and Andrew Mengo, The Turks Today. But you know, it seems as though you know, given the chance, wouldn't you just pick them all up?
All the way back here.
Well, good evening, and thank you for a wonderful presentation. I'd like to ask you, Andrea, what was it in your high school career that motivated you to study biology originally in college, and what was it that you could have done in high school, such as writing for the school paper or one of the literature items that you may have done and not recognized your own talents as a high school student?
I think a lot of why I got interested in biology in high school was because I grew up near the ocean. I was interested specifically in marine biology, in life at the edge of the ocean. Woods Hole is not far from where I lived, and so that was a great inspiration. And also, more simply, I went to a very small high school in what was then quite a rural area. I had a good biology teacher. Sometimes one teacher in one field when you're that age will just light a fire in you. I actually disliked high school very much and was generally a very poor student. So I didn't do those sensible things like writing for the school newspaper or doing something with dramatics because I didn't like anybody and I didn't like the teachers and I didn't like the classes. So I opted out of most things, but I had this one really good biology teacher and that's what stuck. I don't think I could imagine a life as a writer then. I was a great reader, but I had never met a living writer. I think I actually did not formulate the idea that a person who was alive could be a writer. Writers were dead, and they usually lived in either Russia or England. It just didn't cross my mind that it was something I could do until really very much later.
Town in Massachusetts did you attend high school?
I went to Barnstable High School for 3 years in the middle of the Cape. My father was quite restless, so we moved just about every 18 months or 2 years most of my life, but it was all over the lower and middle Cape. So Barnstable High School was the place I was the longest. Are you from the Cape? Uh-huh.
Another question? Over here on my left.
Could you talk about the difference between writing a novel and a short story and how you decide when to do one and when to do the other? And it sounds like in the case of the latest novel, you sort of had characters doing both. So,
I don't really know how I decide. Sometimes, most of the time, it's been my experience that the piece announces itself fairly early as a short story or a novel. I don't really know how that comes about, and I'm not really sure how I know, but I do usually know. A couple times I've been fabulously wrong. The Voyage of the Narwhal I thought was a short story. I meant it to be a short story, and it became quite a long novel. And I wrote one story that at one point was almost 150 pages long. It's now 40 pages. So it's possible to make the mistake in the other direction. People often say that stories concern a small group of characters, sometimes only one character, at a relatively constrained moment in time, and usually have to do with something about the individual in conflict or passing through a group. But I don't actually write stories like that. I write stories that have a lot of people in them that sometimes take place over great chunks of time. And I write novels like that, too, so it's somewhat of a mystery to me. I sometimes have the sense that there's this great big swath of fabric that's just lying out there in front of me, and then I have a big pair of scissors, and I go in and I cut it at one end, and oops, sorry, and then I cut it off at the other end, and if it's a long cut, it's a novel, and if it's a short cut, not a novel. But it must be more complicated than that, but I don't know how to explain it. You've written both. Do you have a sense of that?
I've written very few stories. Mm-hmm. I wrote some a couple novellas, and that was just always the length they were going to be. That's just how they came.
Just how they came, I guess, is the answer. Not satisfying, I know, but true.
Another question? In the green, about three rows back.
This is a question for Ms. Nassoud regarding your book, When the World Was Steady. I thought your descriptions of the sister who went to Bali were written with such a lucid clarity and a veracity that it could only have been lived. Am I right, or were they researched?
I had been to Bali. I had been to all the places that everybody went in that book. And for me, it's a novel about two sisters in different places at the same time. One of them takes a trip to Bali, and the other takes a trip to the Isle of Skye, and for me the places were as much characters. When I set out to write the book, I wanted to write as much about the places as about the people. The Isle of Skye in Scotland.
Time for a few more questions. Right in the front row here, gentlemen.
First, thank you for a pair of lovely readings. I see it appears from your readings that you've each chosen the reliable narrator, but there's an interesting difference that seemed to come across in terms of how much exposition was coming from the narrator as opposed to the dialogue. And I'm wondering how you make that distinction, or is it even a conscious choice?
A tough one.
Yeah, that's a wonderful and wonderfully sophisticated question. I'm fascinated that you could get that just by listening to it. And I do think it's true. I know Claire's book on the page as well as hearing it. And I've often thought about her narrator. It is one of the first things a writer has to decide about a book. I'm not sure that we decide it consciously. I think few of us say to ourselves, oh, I'm going to have a narrator that has these properties, that's going to release information in this way, that's going to have this tonality. It's usually a question of writing sentences and sentences and sentences, and often knowing, well, that's not the right narrative voice, that's not the right narrative tone, and inching into other areas until finally we hit one that feels right. I know that was the case with my own book because it has this complex, plural, omniscient narrator. It's a very odd voice, and in some ways it made the book quite difficult to write, and yet I never could write the book without that voice. I tried to give it up because it was making the book so complicated, and the book just had to be written in that voice, so I had to operate within those rules. Do you want to talk about how you settled on your narrative voice?
No. I don't really have anything to say. I mean, it is as unhelpful as the earlier question about the length of things. I mean, there is something that
as Andrea says, it either feels right or it doesn't, and the narrative voice in this novel is different from the narrative voice in my. I mean, each book has a different narrative voice, and this one is perhaps more offers more opinions than others do. I think it is just it's about finding what seems the form that seems to fit the content, you know, and it isn't conscious. It's about stumbling around it isn't about thinking, oh well, I need now to make to create a more interventionist, it isn't really.
Does it come after revisions?
Yes, for many of us it does. It's the rare writer who gets the voice absolutely dead on with the early drafts, with the early pages. But I mean, the awful truth about this is that many times our good readers know much more about what's going on the page than we do. That's not as crazy as it sounds. We're not blind. We're not unconscious. We're not crazy. We are driving the bus. We know what we're doing, but we're operating in a more intuitive level than our readers are. Readers take the text on the page, and it is transparent to you, obviously, from that wonderful question, what is going on in terms of narrative voice. You see it from the outside, and you can say, oh, she's chosen to do this or chosen to do that. We can't always see that when we're writing. We often can't see it when we're writing, yet we do still make choices as we're writing. We make them with every sentence and every paragraph. They have to do with sound a lot of time, how a sentence sounds in our inner ear, and how that sound fits a certain set of characters and situations. But it is strangely unconscious, at least for me, and I think it sounds like for you too.
I think for me, at least, as the years go by, it seems increasingly, although I have never composed anything analogous to the composition of music, that you just... You have a sense of what is necessary orally or narratively. You just have a feeling that, the bass drum goes here, and you just have to do it and find a way to do that. It's about finding a way to create proportions or rhythms or counterpoints or something at any different moment, and it's about figuring out the ways to accomplish that. In terms of the oral, when you were talking about the music, I mean, I think the music of it is incredibly important. And there's this funny thing that sometimes a word you get very wedded to a single word. You feel this is the only word that will do. I always have this problem. I grew up in Australia and Canada as well as the United States, and I'm not always very sure what the American word is for something, and it's something that critics sometimes are unhappy about. But in my head, I remember having a fight with an editor over, I wanted the word singlet. I really wanted singlet. And she said, I couldn't have it. It had to be undershirt. And I said, but no, singlet is what it is in my head. And she said, I don't care what it is in your head. It's America and it's an undershirt. But there is this funny way in which, the world in my head, the Canadian, the Australian, all the different vocabularies are all sort of mashed into one. It isn't.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. One syllable too many.
And the stress is in the wrong place. It's a nightmare.
So.
Folks, one more question. In back here on the left, about 10 rows back.
Hi, Andrea. I had a question. I really enjoyed in your novels and your short stories how characters reoccur. I'm wondering what causes that to happen. What's the thinking behind that? Is it just something that happens organically, or are you consciously making choices to return to characters?
It happens organically to an extent that it's a little frightening to me. I didn't actually choose initially to intertwine all these characters from all these books. By now it's, there's a, I finally printed at the back of The Air We Breathe this chart. It's a giant family tree that has been growing on my wall for about 12 years. My editors wanted me to print it in earlier books, and I didn't want to because I knew it wasn't done, and I didn't want to with this one because I knew it wasn't done, but nonetheless, it's in there. It keeps spreading. It spreads back in time. It spreads out in wings to the side. It adds whole wings I hadn't even known were there. Someone asked me the other day if I could conceive any more of writing stories that didn't have characters who were connected tangentially, at least, to other characters I had already made. And I had to confess I can't somehow conceive of that now. And I know that because I've several times now had the very disturbing experience of saying to myself, I'm tired of this gigantic extended set of 5 million families. I just want to write a story with some fresh people that's not connected to anything. And I start the story, and it's in a time I've not used before, in a city I've not used before, with characters I don't know. I write a few pages, I write half a draft, and then the next morning I wake up, and the thought that's in my head that morning is roughly, oh my God, of course, she's the brother of the mother's aunt of the sister of Tony's, you know, grandmother. And, you know, my brain has invented some often quite convoluted way to tangentially weave that person into the web. So what is it in me that keeps wanting to tie everything together? You know, maybe it's nothing more complicated than apparently this is the way I express metaphorically the same thing we all always know, which is that everything is connected. We actually all are connected. Everything in the world is connected, and maybe I just express it in this weird character way. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they probably stray away from it because it's uncomfortably confining on occasion. Now when I make something, I have to think, wait, but is her aunt really there at that year? And, you know, was this really connected to this other thing? It becomes a considerable challenge after a while, but it's also a nice challenge. It's like writing in sonnet form if you're a poet. The shape, the way I'm boxed in by the form actually seems to bring new ideas out in me at this point, and that's a good thing.
And these two are a good thing. Thanks to our two friends, and please join us upstairs. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.